If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's a rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of Spirit of the Game. I am delighted. Let me tell you, I am delighted today. What a guest we have today, the one and only Jim Urbina. Jim, thank you for joining.
My pleasure, Ed. Thank you for having me.
Wow. Well, first of all, let's start out with who the heck is Jim Urbina? I mean, unless you're Ed Mate, or if you're a Martian, I guess you know who Jim Urbina is. But tell us who you are, where you came from, how you got involved in golf, and why you're worthy of being a guest on Spirit of the Game.
Well, Ed, I'm still not worthy, but I will tell you that my introduction into golf started 43 years ago now, Ed. Beginning my craft as a golf course architect, designer, little did I know that I was going to be. I was actually a shaper, started with the iconic Pete Dye at the TPC of Plum Creek. I tell people all the time, how'd you get in the business? And I tell them I couldn't get a real job. Mm-hmm. And they all laugh and get a kick out of that. But really, it was the truth. I graduated from the University of Northern Colorado with a degree in education. And I couldn't get a teaching appointee because I graduated in the wintertime. So I had to have something to do. And I was going to go fight fires again for the summer because that's what I did in the summertime. I would fight forest fires while I was in college. And my soon-to-be father-in-law said, you got to go get a job. And he got me a job at the TPC at Plum Creek. Little did I know that it would be designed by the iconic Pete Dye. I didn't play golf, didn't know anything about golf. Golf was for those other people. And so 43 years later, Ed, I'm still designing and building golf courses around the country and in foreign countries. And so to make a long story short, I'm in the golf business today still. But as you know, I play the game a little bit different. I treat the game a little bit different. And so I may be the perfect guy for you today. I might be the perfect guy.
All right. We're going to get into that. I know what you're talking about. And again, this is a rules of golf podcast, but the rules of golf are really what define the game. So as an architect, you are really dealing with the very fabric of the game of golf. And so the rules, people say, what does an architect have to do with the rules of golf podcast? And I would take it easy there on my desk here. I'm ruining our audio. You know, and my answer would be everything. Golf course design is, again, the really woven into the rules. So let's just start. And you wrote something up here on the wall. So we might as well get it out of there. You said, I wish for only one rule in golf, play it as it lies. Why don't you elaborate on that?
So, you know, Ed, that there were originally 13 rules of golf. And you and I have debated for years that these rules were only put in to help you perform a little bit better as you played the game. And we're so busy trying to bend the rules in order to favor ourselves that I said to you one day, you know, Ed, we ought to just play it as it lies. And I know it's more difficult than that, but that's really what I feel, is that the game of golf has become too complicated. The game of golf has become sometimes too fabricated. And in the spirit of the game, as Bernard Darwin would say, you really should just take the hole as it is laid out to you and play it as it lies. But I know that the game of golf has way more rules and it has way more stipulations. And Ed, you and I both know I don't keep score. So a good match play at Common Ground would be the perfect setup for me.
Yeah. Well, we have had conversations over the years, and we'll keep it at the, I want to keep it at the top layer about, but you've asked me, you've gotten on the phone and called and said, how would you mark this?
Yes.
And I remember you asking me a question about one of your golf courses, and it had you were trying to connect a bunker or walk around a bunker. And let's remind me to come back to that. Cause there are times as an architect, you really do have some, and again, you report to committees and boards, and they can't ignore the rules of golf.
No, they can't.
You can't just be off in Never Never Land, you know, being very
utopia.
Yeah, just designing golf the way you want it. You have to think about the rules.
Yeah.
So how do the rules of golf enter your mind as you, in all the years, the 43 years you've been doing this? You know, when somebody says, what do you think about the rules of golf and how do they relate to your work? What comes to mind?
What comes to mind for me is that sometimes the rules of golf dictate the style of architecture that I would create, that we create. I started, as you know, I started with the iconic Pete Dye. And sometimes some of his craftiness, sometimes some of his strategy was dictated by rules. And I know that the Island Green at Sawgrass has to have rules in order to complete the hole, to finish it out. So I understand that. You can't just play it as it lies. Mm-hmm. If I hit it in the water, I can't go climb down into the pond and hit the stroke. I get that. Mm-hmm. So there are rules that pertain to architecture. But I think it's just become overbearing that the rules of golf has sometimes stifled the creativity of the architect. And I just think that sometimes, as I said, I wish we only had one rule, play it as it lies, because golf courses all start to look alike when the scorecard and the rules dictate how it should be played. And that's my only worrisome, is that I feel that architecture could be stifled beyond just the rules, beyond just the way you play the game, beyond the expectations of the golfer, that we should just enjoy the golf for what it is, the hazards that are laid out the way they are, and not try to apply, mathematical things. Like, if I could read this quote to you, and I think it's important. Mr. J.L. Lowe said somewhere that most golf courses are too physical and mathematical, while only the best introduce as well as philosophical and strategic elements. Say, only the best golf courses introduce the philosophical and strategic element. And sometimes we depend too much on the physical and the mathematical. That's my mantra. That's my feeling about the rules of golf as they apply to architecture. It stifles us, and I just wished it didn't so much.
Right. So let's go back to Plum Creek for a minute. And this just came to mind as you were talking about the Sawgrass Island Green. The railroad ties that you'll find at a lot of Pete Dye golf courses, I was told that he was very particular in terms of the downhill par three on the back, number 11. Did I get that right?
It's number 12.
12. Okay. Yeah, I forgot. 10, 11, 12. 11 is the par five. Those railroad ties are sort of laid in at an angle so that they're not just straight up and down.
Correct.
And they were treated as, in the rules parlance, integral parts of the course. So you weren't going to get relief from them, even though they're man-made.
Yep.
Did you have any involvement in placing those railroad ties? How did that work? And where did the rules, were the rules part of the equation as those were getting installed?
I don't remember the rules being part of the equation at Plum Creek, but I do remember the rules being a factor at Arizona State University when we did the golf course for Solheim, Karsten Solheim, at Arizona State University. We had some fan walls built. And behind this green, the fan walls built up so the ties were an obstruction. Mm-hmm. And I remember Pete asking somebody who was in with us during the walk around, if the ball comes to rest against that tie wall, how do I play relief? And I remember Pete talking about having a backswing. Mm-hmm. And some of the people on the committee that worked for the Sun Angel Foundation, were worried about how you would play that ball. And Pete said, just drop the ball. That's how Pete would deal with it. Just drop the ball over there. Well, we both know it's more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. No closer to the green, so on and so forth. But I do remember the railroad ties and the bulkheading playing a role in how we designed this hole. It was the back of the green on hole number three, I believe. And we were trying to get a fan wall of ties, Pete Dye's theme back then in the 80s. We were trying to get a fan wall to protect the tee on for the fourth hole. And so the rules committee, the rules people came out and said, how were we able to make that backswing? And Pete was simple and just said, just drop the ball over there. And I know it was more complicated, as I said, but it was a factor. Those railroad ties were always a factor. Where the ball came to rest next to a lake's edge, where it came to rest next to a bunker. How would you be able to advance the ball out of the bunker? Was the angle of the tie sufficient enough to let the ball, when well struck, advance and exit the bunker? So Pete Dye's railroad ties were always a common problem in the rules of golf.
Yeah. So you're, and by the way, we glossed over this so quickly and dove right in, which is good. But, you know, your work, you know, you're a Colorado native growing up in Pueblo, and you had a very big involvement at Common Ground in designing six of those greens. And just want to make sure we don't leave that out of this conversation, that your pedigree in the state of Colorado, you've done courses all over the world.
Yes.
But you've done so. Thank you for the work you did at Common Ground, and I may come back to that.
Yeah.
So Golden Age architecture, and that might be a little too far because, and we'll just let this conversation unfold. But when I think about what is the Golden Age of architecture? What is the span of time?
It's perceived to be between 1910 and just before the Depression. Okay. 1931.
So what's really interesting to me about that in this conversation, that was the emergence of the steel shaft, was in that kind of starting to emerge. The 14 club rule, and we had Rand Jarrus on one of these a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about the history of the rules.
Yeah.
So in that era, were they, when golf courses were being designed, were they being designed for hickory and gutta percha, or what was going on there with equipment?
So great question. As I studied the evolution of golf course architecture from the late 1800s to early 1900s to just before the Depression to after the war to the 50s and 60s to the 80s and 90s and now in today's realm of design, what I learned was that the bunker placement started at, in the early 1900s, between 180 and 220 yards. That was a normal distance off the tee for a hazard, a fairway hazard, something to maneuver the ball around. And then after the war, it changed to 240 to 260. And then the turning points that we talked about, the designs, the turning points of a dogleg, they were set at 800 feet, 266 yards. And then I remember in the late 80s, when we went to Arizona State University, Pete said, we're done making our turning points at 266 yards. We're going to take them to 900 feet, 300 yards. Mm-hmm. And so the evolution of the bunker and the turning point, or the dogleg, was evolving from the time the Golden Age design started, early 1900s, to today, the evolution of the bunker, where it was placed, the as you talked about, the steel shaft, those were all changing. And as I studied Golden Age designs, I realized that, geez, back then, they were barely carrying 180 yards to 220 yards for a drive off the tee. Now, the ball would roll longer, as you know, because the ergonomics of the turf were much firmer, much browner, but the bunkers and the hazards started at 180 to 220. And now today, at Pebble Beach, it's not unheard of for somebody to be carrying a bunker 350 yards off the tee. What a change in evolution.
Yeah. Well, I've always said that the biggest, the best way to study the evolution of the game, one of the best ways through a golf lens, is to look at the rules related to the putting green. Because if you think about the original, and Rand Jarrus, by the way, corrected me. He said they're not the original. They're the first known written, but they're not the original, because the game existed for centuries before that written code was discovered or whatever survived.
Yep.
And he also pointed out that that code was written for a specific competition. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the way the game was always played. And so he sort of, I'll never use the term original 13 anymore. Just we'll say the first recorded.
Yes.
But in the first recorded rules was this idea of teeing the ball within one club length of the putting of the hole.
Love it.
So the idea was you'd scoop it out of the hole, put the ball on this tee, and off you go. Well, you can imagine with that green look like.
Yes.
So you just finished a pretty big project out in California at Paso Tiempo.
Yes.
So I think it's worth spending just a little bit of time talking about that project, because it was all about greens, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And basically recapturing the spirit of greens that could no longer weren't designed for the speed and the agronomy of today.
That's correct.
So I would love to hear more about how you approach that project.
So golf courses evolve, Ed. Back in 1928, when Robert Hunter, Alistair McKenzie, and Marion Hollins being the woman who developed Paso Tiempo, started to dream about the layout at Paso Tiempo. They were talking about a golf course that back then was off the tee, was only measuring around 6,400 yards. And today it measures more than that. But today, even today, Paso Tiempo still holds itself because of the elevation changes and the greens. But just so you know, the bunkers I just talked about, the bunkers being set at 180 to 220. In Alistair McKenzie's designs, he never thought about a bunker being 120 or 180 or 240. He talked about a various types of bunkers scattered out throughout the property at different lengths. So there wasn't no mathematical compilation attached to that hole. You could have a bunker at 360. You could have a bunker at 280. But he wasn't talking about the style of game at the time. But the key to Paso Tiempo was the greens. And I tell people on the front nine of Paso Tiempo, there's almost 10 feet of fall on holes number 5 and holes number 8, two par threes. 10 feet of fall from back to front.
Just the green.
Just the green itself. Yeah. And on the back nine, the same thing again. Two greens that had fall of over 10 feet. And so people would say, well, how can you have a green that rolls at 12 or 13% on the stimp meter perform and be able to have a pinning locations? Well, the pinning locations were long lost many years ago. People always thought, oh, the greens were original Paso Tiempo. They had been changed many times, even by Alistair McKenzie himself. So we just recaptured the putting cups, the putting pin locations. Sometimes where only one existed, like on the 8th green at Paso Tiempo, only one green valid pin location existed on the top. But because the green had been top dressed so much, the well of the green, the contours of the green had all been filled up with sand, years and years of top dressing, almost 100 years. And so we just recaptured those pinning locations. And when you recapture those cupping areas, those pinning locations, the speeds can be at 9 and 10, and you could have greens that will hold a shot, even though it falls almost one story from back to front. And so we were able to capture those. And the key of a golden age design, such as what Alistair McKenzie did at Paso Tiempo, was to have very creative pinning locations, very creative green locations, bunkers that would protect certain parts of the green itself. And when you recapture all of that that was lost due to evolutions of golf, the top dressing of the greens, then the spirit of his game comes back, the spirit of his design, the spirit of which he intended the golf course to play like. But when it has green speeds of 12 and 13 and all the cupping area is gone, then the spirit's kind of gone. And people call it a joke, make fun of it. And we've recaptured all of that. And that is the spirit of the game.
So that project is done.
It's done. Yes.
And what is the green speed you were targeting in building those greens?
9.5 to 10.
Okay. And before that, were they, you mentioned much faster. Were they trying?
Much faster.
So that's almost like you give them a user's manual. They say, please do not exceed.
It's covered under warranty.
Yeah, as long as you maintain them at 9.5.
It's under warranty as long as it's 9.5 to 10. But really, it doesn't need to be more than that. That's the biggest crux of architecture, is the architect gets blamed for the for the style of architecture of the green when the green's speeds are absurd.
Yeah.
Who gets the blame? Not the superintendent, not the owner, the architect. Why would he build greens like that? Mm-hmm. Well, when the speeds are unobtainable,
right,
then the architecture goes away. And we simply recaptured that. I asked the club, the superintendent, to keep the speeds at 9.5 and 10. And now that they got pure bent on them instead of POA, they roll true. The ball doesn't oscillate. It has some friction. Mm-hmm. And so 9.5 and 10 on pure bent greens are doable and entertaining and fun and all of those things that golf should be about. I never talk about what I shot on the Ed, when I walk off the common ground, you don't ask me what I shot today. How much fun did you have? And right. And that's really what the spirit of the game is about for me and golf course architecture.
So staying with green speed for a minute, because this is a soapbox of mine, big one, is I think green speeds, and I know you agree with me, have gotten out of hand. As you just pointed out here, you're talking about an iconic classic course at 9.5, 10. Let's talk about it again. I'm not in terms of the spirit of the game.
Yes.
The idea of getting a ball into the hole. What do you think fast greens do to take away from the enjoyment or your idea of what golf should be about? And why would you say, why are fast greens a problem? Because I bring this up a lot.
Yeah.
And I say, how do you like the greens? And I love them fast, faster the better. And it's like, so maybe you can help me come up with a better answer than the one I've been able to come up with.
Well, you know, people who were fascinated by the speed of the green, to me, are really about making sure their putt rolls true. Speed, trueness of the ball, the rollout, how it rolls out. Does it oscillate? Does it wobble? And I think speed gives you that non-oscillation type of feeling when you make that stroke. But you really only need speed of greens for entertainment value when you're putting on your kitchen table, the flat top table that you're putting on. That's the only type of greens that you need speed. Golf courses in Florida that have flattish greens, they need speed for entertainment. But when you have greens like Pasa Tempo and like some greens at Augusta National, and my favorite golf course, the National Golf Links of America, when you're putting on greens like that that have way more strategy, way more pin placement, way more the ability to feed the ball onto the green, you don't want speeds that high because the ball could enter the green with high velocity. And when green speeds are fast, the ball exits at high velocity. And so the entertainment factor of a green on a flat green, sure, make them as fast as you want. That's the only entertainment value that you're going to get on a flat green. But on a green that has contours, like one of my favorite greens at Common Ground, the 14th. Ed, I wonder why that green's so fun. Because it has a lot of contour.
Yeah.
It doesn't need speed to challenge you as a putter. It doesn't need speed to challenge you as a ball striker. It doesn't need speed to challenge you in overcoming par. Its challenge is putting the ball in the right location, making a simple stroke to get the ball into the hole, not as you see on TV sometimes, like they did at Pebble Beach and like they do at Torrey Pines, where they just touch the ball and it takes off rolling. That's not fun. That's not a putting stroke. That's not the game of golf. That's trying to make sure the ball doesn't fall off the green. And that's what speeds do. And I don't mean to use the word speed kills, but that's what it does to the entertainment value of a green. When you're just touching the ball and it rolls uncontrollably off the green, that's not fun. That's not fun.
Yeah. So you alluded to this when you talked about would you say mathematical?
Yes.
And I know you're not, there's a saying in your circles about card and pencil golf.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I know I'm going to, so why don't you just talk about, because again, why do we write rules? Why do we even have rules? We have rules when you're trying to compare one golfer to another. If you just went out and you don't need rules to go for a hike, no. Just go do what you want, right? So why do we have rules? Well, we have rules because it's a competition.
It's a competition.
Right. So competition and rules go together.
Yes.
Right. If we didn't compete, if it wasn't in our DNA to be competitors, and those two shepherds who took off against each other, but that was the point. They took off against each other. It didn't matter how many strokes they took, as long as one did less than the other or whatever. So what has the card and pencil done to the game in your heart and mind?
I'd like to read this quote, if you don't mind. This is from Dr. Alistair McKenzie, Golf Architecture. It says, and I quote, "There are some leading players, you know what that means, Ed, who honestly dislike the dramatic element in golf. They hate anything that is likely to interfere with a constant succession of threes and fours. They look upon everything in the card and pencil spirit," end quote, which means as long as I'm scoring good and as long as I'm beating my opponent and all of the other opponents in that day, I am good. I'm a successful golfer. I'm the card and pencil mentality. But if I may add this, and I quote, "The average club member, on the other hand, is a keen sportsman. He looks upon golf in the spirit of adventure. And that is why St. Andrews and other golf courses modeled on similar ideals appeal to him. The average golfer, the spirit of adventure. He's not worried about what he's going to score. But I understand that's what competition does. I understand why the leading money winners on the tour, they care about that scorecard and they care about the rules, not the average person. He looks upon golf as a spirit of adventure."
Yeah. You think that's the first written card and pencil? You think that's the origination of that term?
Yes, I believe McKenzie was the quote. Several other Golden Age designers talked about it. A.W. Tillinghast. A.W. Tillinghast in the 30s said, if I could quote this quote to you, he said, "The merit of any hole is not judged by its length, but rather by its interest in its variety and elective play is apparent. It's not how far, but how good." And that's A.W. Tillinghast talking about this yardage that we have to have. Golf courses over 7,000 or 8,000 yards. And it's not about how long it is. It's about how good it is. And they were talking about this back in the 30s and then in the 20s, the card and pencil, the mathematical, John Lowe talks about the mathematical presentation. A.W. Tillinghast talks about the fetish of length. These are all the books that I consume. And they were worried about them then. And I still worry about them today, that the average golfer, Ed, that's me. I'm looking for the spirit of adventure. How many times could I enjoy myself during the day? Not whether I got a three on a par four or I got a birdie on a one-shot hole. That's not my game.
Right.
We're the average people. You other guys, you play for that card and pencil. More power to you.
Do you think that there are more card and pencil golfers out there than a spirit of adventure golfers?
I think if you watch TV, they're all card and pencil
golfers. No, of course. We know that. They're making a living on card and pencil.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm talking about just in the thing about the clientele that go to Band and Dunes. Think about the clientele that come to Common Ground.
Yeah.
I have my own answer. What do you think? Do you think most golfers are card and pencil golfers? And again, this is evolving as you look at Top Golf and as you look at kind of the new entry and the gamification and the video stuff. Maybe that's evolving. But what do you think?
I think that I would say more than half of the people who walk out the door at Common Ground are looking to better their game.
Yeah.
And when they better their game, the only way they know how to judge that is by a score. But as you know, Ed, when I walk out that door, if I get a par or a birdie and I hit a shot that I've never hit before, that's the betterment of my game. And I don't need a pencil to tell me that I'm getting better. I could feel it, the on-the-ground shot, the once in a lifetime 7-iron. But yes, more than half, maybe 75%, I truly believe, walk out that door at Common Ground hoping to score better that day, because that is the satisfaction that they're getting better at what they do.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And I would agree. And you're unusual. And in a lot of ways. Yeah. Thank goodness. Right. This would be a weird world if there were more. It would be a good world, actually. Okay. But seriously, how often do you, I'm guilty of this. I mean, when I go play, I got my handicap, the Colorado Golf Association. We talked about the rules of golf, but we're also the representatives of the USGA course rating system.
Yes, you have to be.
And so let's to talk about that just for a bit. Ballyneal, which you were not, I know that was designed during your time working with Tom Doak, and you spent quite a bit of time. You were out at Sabonic. Well, that was getting, which was kind of a shame because you had a home game and you had to go across the world.
Had to go farther away.
Right. But one of the coolest things about Ballyneal, and I know they're not alone in this, but they're pretty unique in that there are no tee markers. And there is a course rating, but it's never publicized.
Right.
And it's fascinating to watch the card and pencil players come out there and kind of struggle with, they want that, not just the score that they can brag about over a beer, but the score they can stamp and put in that handicap and say, there it is.
Yes.
And it's just fun to see the way people respond to that.
And there's nothing wrong with that, Ed. But the opposite of that is when, and I'm very familiar with Ballyneal. I spent 2 or 3 years with Rupert O'Neill out there laying out golf holes and thinking about things that we were going to build out there before I had to go to Sabonic. But the problem with the rules and the card and pencil guys is that when they three putt the eighth green at Ballyneal, now they have a different attitude. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer, I just got a bogey. Now it's, that green is unfair. The U word. I hate the U word.
Yeah.
It's like the F word.
Yeah.
I hate to use it. Unfair. Yeah. And so it plays both sides. You see the improvement of your game, but the minute you four putt the eighth green at Ballyneal, then there's something wrong here because you've ruined my score for the day. He says anything that interferes with the constant succession of threes and fours.
Yeah.
That's the card and pencil mentality.
Yeah.
So I wish that people could overlook those sometimes bad putting stroke or inconvenient ball landing in a part of the green where you can't get that par putt and enjoy it for the spirit of the game. But I understand why people keep score. They want to feel like they're playing better.
So in all your years in design, how have you had the opportunity to, I know you worked with Nicklaus and we can talk about that, but you weren't working with Nicklaus during his prime as a player.
No.
But have you had the chance to play with a tour player in their prime? And did you see something there that made you, that helped inform, it kind of changed
Yes. And people think, well, you know, this guy, he doesn't care about the scorecard. He doesn't care about rules. I have to care about all of that, Ed.
Yeah.
I try to downplay it.
Yeah.
But I played with Jay Siegel, best amateur. I played with him at the San Francisco Golf Club. I'm not trying to drop names. I'm just telling you, you asked me the question. I played with Jay Siegel. I played with some of the best amateur players. I played with Ian Baker Finch after he had just won the British Open. I played with Nicklaus even as his career was winding down, but I still had to understand how he thought and how he played. I got to tell you this story.
Yeah.
Sabonic Golf Club. We're laying out the seventh hole, and we have a bunker over on the right side of the seventh hole, dog leg left, and I'm down in the bunker and we're getting ready to shape it. And I'm the design associate at Sabonic. And Nicklaus gets down there and says, Jim, that bunker face is too steep. And I said, well, I think it's pretty good. I think it's the right angle for the location of the bunker. He says, I can't advance my ball to the green. And I said, why do you have to advance your ball to the green? No disrespect, Jack. And he said, Jim, how many majors have you won? And I said, I had to think about it for a while. None, Jack. And of course, he tells me how many majors he won. So you see that it plays in even the best players. That's what they think about. And as Jack Nicklaus is the architect designer, he thinks about the guy who lands in that bunker should be able to advance his ball to the green. And the best amateurs that I play golf with, they think about how to navigate to get, they learn how to miss. They learn where to miss. And so they don't get in trouble. And so I know where those guys play. I know where the shots they make. And so I'm familiar with it. But I try not to let it interfere with who I'm really trying to design the golf course for, the average club member, the average golfer who is looking to be entertained. And so I respect what good players do, but I remember the people like Jack Nicklaus who thinks about scoring, who thinks about recoverability, who thinks about placement of the ball, the angle of the green, how big the green should be in relation to the type of shot going in there. I know about all of that. But I'm trying to go back to the spirit of the game, Ed, and that's what I'm driven by in the golden age of design. That's what I'm driven about. And when we do Pacific Dunes and Old MacDonald at the Abandoned Dunes Resort for Mike Kaiser, I think about those things. I think about the average golfer. How is he going to get around? How is this woman? How's my wife going to get navigate the golf course? And those other guys, those really good card and pencil guys, they'll be entertained too because their goal is to just keep getting better and better on the scorecard. And I'll just keep trying to provide golf courses that are more fun and entertaining and allow for strategic play. And when you walk off of the 18th green at Common Ground, how much fun did we have, Ed? Yeah. How much fun did we have today? Yeah.
So I have another question about Nicklaus. And do you... You know, if you ask somebody who's paid a little bit of attention to golf course design, there's sort of these, and I wanted you to respond to this if you think this is true or not, that Jack Nicklaus, I'm not trying to get you in trouble because I know how much respect you have for Jack Nicklaus, and you gained even more respect working with him intimately, that he designed holes for his game, that he hit the ball left or right, that he hit high towering approach shots, and he liked the challenge of the second shot. Do you think that's true?
It absolutely is true. I remember laying out the 13th hole at Sabonic. Ron Witten was there that day documenting. He can attest to this. Jack was setting up the dog leg. He wanted to set up the dog leg with an inside bunker. Inside bunker, outside bunker. But in the case of the 13th hole at Sabonic, it was an inside bunker and an outside lake edge. And I said underneath my breath, Ron Witten wrote it down. I said, oh, not another asshole. And Ron said, did you just say not another bleep hole? I said, no, I didn't say that. I said asshole. And Jack looked at me and kind of chuckled and said, I'm just trying to get him to carry that bunker. He'd like to have him carry a bunker and to get a speed slot so they could get the ball advanced. Now, they were rewarded for carrying a bunker. And I got all of that. But that was only for the one percenters. All this other 99 percenters are going to go way over here to the right, avoid that bunker as much as we can. What McDonald called, C.B. McDonald, the designer of the National Golf Links of America, called tacking. He likened it to a yachtsman who would tack down the fairway to get to his objective. And I would listen to Jack and how here and his son being there talk about how he wanted to have you be rewarded for carrying a bunker. But that was just for the one percenters. And so, yes, I learned a lot from him. Here's another great story.
So wait a minute, because I want to make sure. What is an S-hole?
An S-hole is a hole that tee off and
oh, you mean like the letter S.
Like the letter S.
I gotcha. I thought it was like speed slot or what you were.
Yeah, I was
like,
okay. S-hole.
So, but
right to left, left to right, left, right to left.
Oh, okay. So he was
vice versa.
Right. But so just staying with the one idea and the notion that Nicklaus faded the ball.
Yes.
You think that made his way into his designs?
Yeah. For sure.
Do you think he was aware of that?
For sure he did.
Why would you do that? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. It's like if, I mean,
Because some people thought that the strategy of a golf hole, that you should be able to flight the ball left to right and then right to left. If you were a really good golfer, you could play both shots. And some people felt like Augusta, that if you hit a fade, you were not going to be very good.
Yeah.
Some people thought that if you name the golf course, if you played a draw, you weren't going to be favorable. Jack felt that you had to be able to hit a draw and a fade. Mm-hmm. And that's the way he laid out his golf.
That's sort of silly, because I mean, let me just go right to the what things could would somebody point out and say that I can tell Jim Urbina did that because
the ground game. Okay. It's open in the front. And that leads me to the story I have to tell you.
Okay.
We were playing the 13th hole, Jack and I. You know, we're bros. You know, we're buddies.
So games are similar.
We get
You're the opposite of high. Exactly. You've never hit a ball over 5 feet. You know?
We get to the 13th green, and he's watching me play with a 7-iron right. on all my shots. Yeah. It doesn't matter if I'm 200 yards away or 50
I've
yards
played with
away.
You. I know, Jimmy. I've seen
I hit
it.
The ball on the ground.
Yeah.
And he's walking with the caddy at Sabonic on the 13th hole, and he said, "Is that the only game you know?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, I like to bump it on the ground." And he says, "You know, I could hit that shot, don't you?" And I said, "I don't believe it. I've never seen you hit it yet." Because he hits the ball in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Great players hit the ball in the air. It almost touches the cloud.
Yeah.
And then it lands softly right where they want it to be.
Right.
But so Jack said, "All right, let's have a bet who could get it close to the pin. And I'll use a bump and run." I said, "All right." So I hit my 7-iron up there, and we can't see where the ball ends up. He pulls out, I believe he hit a 6-iron. He gives a caddy for a 6-iron. He bumps the ball up there. We can't see. So we kind of walk fast up to the green. And guess who won it?
I'm going to guess Jack Nicklaus won.
He absolutely did. He absolutely did win. He was much closer.
Yeah.
And he said, "See, I told you." And I said, "Well, if you're so good at it, why don't you do it all the time?" And you know what his answer was? "Because I don't have to."
I don't have to, right.
Because that's the game that those people play.
Yeah.
And again, I get off on tangents because I remember these things, Ed. I remember that good players don't think about hitting the ball on the ground. They think about flying it exactly the right. yardage they were given.
Right.
What does a caddy do? How far is it to the pin? 165. Okay, I get my 165-yard club. And you know why they should be rewarded for hitting the 165 club? Because they sit out on the driving range for hours and hours and hours hitting a 165 shot.
Yeah.
And Jim Urbina, he gets a 7-iron and he hits it 165 or 50 with the same club. He doesn't care. Spirit of adventure. Two different types of games, but yes. Jack thought about how he played, how that ball would release, how that ball would react on a 165-yard chart, because that was important to him.
Do you think his design philosophy evolved now? Where he,
for sure.
Because, I mean, as he's gotten older, and he's got to have gained some appreciation for not everybody, he can't hit those shots anymore.
For the ground game. And I was just with him last year. We told some old stories at the Bears Club. I was with him. We told some old stories. But, you know, I saw what he's done to the Bears Club, and it's evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much – there's still some bunkers. There's still some strategy. But I wouldn't say as much force carry.
Right.
And that's the game that I always knew. That's the game that the Lynx Golf that the Dye sent me to study in Scotland, the ground game. That's what I learned. That's what I brought back. That's what stuck in my head. But I've realized that good golfers, people who practice, they want to be able to hit that ball in the air and land it right on that pin. And more power to them, because they practice way more than I could ever imagine.
So staying again on the topic of the highly skilled players, everybody who's been on this Spirit of the Game podcast has been asked this question.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the roll back of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm very interested to know what your take is on it. You know, there's a large camp
of people who say the USGA was asleep at the wheel. They should have done something a long time ago and they're not doing enough. And there's another camp saying, this is crazy. They're ruining the game. And you know better than anyone, this is not a new debate.
Not a new debate.
So what do you think about this proposal that's on the table to, quote unquote, roll back the golf ball?
Can I give you one quote?
You brought all these books in, and if anybody could see that, if we were a video podcast, it'd be impressed at all your dog-eared and your marks. And yes,
please. I didn't know you were going to ask this question.
No, we went to La Cueva and had red chili. We didn't do any preparing for this.
From the book, Scotland's Gift Golf, Charles Blair MacDonald, He wrote, and I quote, "Viewing the monstrosities created on many modern golf courses, which are a travesty on nature, no golfer can but shudder for the soul of golf. It would seem that in this striving after novelty and innovation, many builders of golf courses believe they are elevating the game. But what a sad compilation." He said this back in the 20s. The monstrosities that we are creating. What do you think my view on rolling back the golf ball is?
Well, that it's, yeah.
Back then they were creating monstrosities. Yeah. Today we're creating monstrosities. If we roll the ball back, who cares if you could only hit it 310 yards?
Yeah.
You're still a skilled player. It's not for the novelty and the innovation. It's for the spirit of the game. That if we get too carried away with the length of the ball, it's a sad compilation of what golf courses are going to happen to them. We're going to run out of acreage. We're going to run out of room. We're going to run out of the amount of water that we have to put down, how many acres we have to mow, and so on and so forth. And so I feel like Charles Blair MacDonald felt many years ago, is that sometimes Tillinghast says the fetish of length. Roll the ball back. Make the golf courses that we have today usable. And or, Ed, we could do this. And I said this at Texas Tech University. They said that the golf course, when we did the golf course at Texas Tech University, said it's not long enough. And I said, well, we could fix that. And it'd be a lot cheaper. He said, how are you going to fix that, the golf pro and the staff? I said, you know how we fix it? We get rid of all the par fives. Well, we can't do that. Why can't we do that? Well, we've got to be able to have birdies and eagles. See how they think about the game? It all goes back to that card and pencil theory. Just get rid of the par fives. Mm-hmm. Let's just make par fours. Get rid of the par threes. Make par two. Who cares? Making it longer is not better. Roll the ball back. Let us enjoy common ground so that we don't have to put a tee box back on Havana Street to make a golf hole relevant. Let's play it as it lies. One of my first rules of golf, rolling the ball back will allow us to play it as it lies.
So in the history of the game, we've never done that. The game is never, and just maybe we finally have gotten to the point where we've literally fallen off the edge of the table and we have to do something. Because you look at the rock to the wood to the feathery to the gutty to the Haskell to the wound to the we've never stepped back.
No.
So this idea is kind of going to be tested, I suppose, for the first time. Now, we all know the greatest rollback of all is to Father Time. Yeah. Let me tell you, my ball is rolling back quickly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that's probably the best governor of all is just we get old.
Who doesn't want to have a Ferrari and not drive it 180 miles an hour?
Yeah.
I get that, Ed.
Yeah.
But I believe that we could enjoy the game more. All of us, including the people who play on TV, if the ball was rolled back and we could enjoy golf courses that don't have to be, as MacDonald said, monstrosities. Mm-hmm. And that would be my stance on it.
Have you played Homestead at Fox Hollow?
Yes.
I love that golf course.
Not a bad golf course.
I love because it's a par whatever.
Yes.
And I remember when it opened, they kind of positioned it as a championship executive, which is typically kind of an oxymoron. But I actually enjoy that length of course.
Yeah.
And it the experience there is not diminished, in my opinion, because it's not a par 72
or correct.
Quote unquote, you know,
championship golf course,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah. All right. So I just listened to, I'm just coming off. This is just spitballing here.
Yep.
Just listened to your Feed the Ball podcast that you do periodically with Derek Duncan. And this is kind of, we're wrapping up because we try to keep these to about 50 minutes.
Perfect.
All right. So you talked about tie-ins and this is really unrelated to the topic of rules, but it really made me reflect on, you know, a tie, and we're not going to get into the details of this, but to me, a tie-in is where one feature meets another feature.
Yes. Yes.
And the world is full of tie-ins, right? Just as you walk around and navigate the world,
yes.
The way this credenza ties into the wall, the way, you know, windows fit into a building, whatever it may be. But what it got me thinking of is just how, you know, when something speaks to you, the emotional side. And I think about, it was funny, I was thinking about what holes or what golf courses in my mind really speak to me. And you know what was funny? And not that this is the only course, but, you know, the front nine, as I knew it, I guess for me it was the back nine at John F. Kennedy Golf Course. As funny as that may sound, the way that course fit into the land in such a subtle, simple way, mm-hmm. I just loved. And it's like, that's not going to make anybody's top 10 list.
No.
But it's just the emotional. And it's honestly, the reason I got there from the topic of tie-ins is the way that piece of land ties in together.
Correct.
So just respond to that. Love to get your thing.
The movement of the land, mm-hmm. how you tie the routing into the movement of the land.
Mm-hmm.
I could say the same thing for common ground. You come off the high precipice of common ground and you go for a walk down into the valley towards the dam and around by the marsh area. And then you work your way back up to the top of the hill. That's a tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of the tie-in is how the bunkers relate to the ground. And then a part of that is how the greens relate to the tie-ins of the bunkers. And you know my favorite hole, 14 at common ground and 11 at common ground, those tie into the landform. Mm-hmm. Abruptly on 14 and kind of subtly on 11, but they're still parts of tie-ins. What Eric Iverson did on some of the holes that he did, 7 and 15. What beautiful tie-ins that he created playing through that valley. I still love those holes day after day. I think about them all the time. What a beautiful job he did tying it in. And the whole golf course ties into the community. It goes away from the clubhouse, out towards the streets of Havana, and it winds down to the beautiful, quiet setting of the wetlands and the dam over on 5 and 6. And then it comes back to the city up on top and the honking horns. And then it goes back out again. Those are all wonderful tie-ins, much like St. Andrews when you're walking back into the city on the old course of St. Andrews. The tie-ins, they're everywhere, from the greens and the bunkers to the tees to the fairways to the routing to the land. And common ground has that tie-in from the highs to the lows and back to the highs. What a cool feeling.
Yeah, well, really beautifully said. And, you know, it's funny, I think about, you know, not just the physical tie-ins, but the emotional tie-ins. And you were so true, because by the time you get to the fifth tee at common ground, or really the fifth green.
Yes,
the traffic noise is gone.
Yes.
The dam obscures everything other than the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And the you hear the chirping birds, you hear the honking geese, and you could be anywhere.
That could be anywhere.
And then you're kind of lost in this journey, and then you come back to reality.
Yeah.
And you touch it again at 9, and then you come back and experience it all over again.
And I talk about in the podcast through the green, the tie-ins through the green.
Mm-hmm.
And what Don Placek did on the 12th hole of common ground, putting Long's Peak in the background behind the green, that's a long tie-in. But it's serenity, it's peacefulness, it's beauty. And I think about that all the time. Tie-ins are as I talk about in the podcast, greens, tees, fairways, and bunkers. But the tie-in to the mountain range with Long's Peak in the background, or I'm sorry, Mount Evans in the background.
No, it's Mount Blue Sky.
Is it Mount Blue Sky?
No, it's no longer Mount Evans. They changed the name.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I'll call it Mount Evans.
Yeah, you're not allowed.
I'm allowed to do that.
We'll call it Mount Urbino.
Okay, thank you.
No, Mount Placid.
Mount Placid, but it's the tie-ins. And it could be everything. And it's the walk that you enjoy with the people and the tie-ins to the city and the community. It's all part of it, Ed. It's all part of it.
Well said. Well, Jim, this was fun. We'll do it again. This is part one of many. All right. And thanks for all you do for golf in Colorado.
My pleasure, Ed. Thank you for having me.
You bet.